We're going to look at Mark chapter 1, verses 35 to 45 this morning. One of the things we're going to find as we read through Mark's gospel is that Jesus constantly does things that are unexpected. So last week we saw Jesus calling fishermen to leave their boats, stop mending their nets and just go and follow him. We saw him cast out demons, we saw him heal Simon Peter's mother-in-law, and we said last week it was showing that his is a kingdom of mercy, a kingdom of power, a kingdom of healing, inner healing, real spiritual healing. And we left off last week with this scene of these crowds all gathered around the door of the house where Jesus was staying. The sun had set, there's no street lights or anything like that, And yet these people, they can't wait until the morning. There are sick people there. There are demon-possessed people. And they need to be healed. We can't wait till the next day. And he does. He heals. In verse 34, it says, he healed many. Even after the sunset, he just keeps on healing and healing into the night. He goes. So, you got to the end of verse 34, you get your remote control out and imagine you can press pause at this point. What happens next? Well, surely when he does eventually stop healing in the darkness and he goes to bed, surely he's going to get up the next morning and carry on the job. He's not finished, has he? There's more people who need to be healed. And there's always going to be someone new with a fever. There's always going to be more people who get sick and need to be healed. So he'll stay there in Capernaum. He'll carry on healing. Maybe, he'll build up his power base of loyal supporters in Capernaum. Maybe at some point he'll set up a network of healing ministries. And eventually he'll be anointed king of Israel. And Israel will be free and prosperous. And it all starts there in Capernaum. I think that's more or less what these brand new disciples who have just left their nets to follow him, I think that's more or less what they've mapped out in their heads that they think is going to happen next. They think he's going to get up the next day and carry on healing. It's quite a natural thing to expect, isn't it? That he'll carry on healing people. But he doesn't. In verse 35, he gets up very early in the morning. He goes out to a solitary place. And there he prays. And when you look at verse 37, it's very clear that's not what the disciples expected. The crowd start looking for Jesus in the morning. They come back to the house and he's not there. And so Simon goes, and eventually when the disciples, they all finally say, look, everyone's looking for you. In fact, the word looking there, it's searching or even hunting. People are scouring the streets, knocking on doors, looking behind bushes. He's got to be somewhere. We've got to find him. They're hunting for Jesus because they thought he'd still be there at the house to carry on healing. Why isn't he there? It's because Jesus has two great priorities. They're going to be what we think about this morning. Two great priorities. And here's the first one. Jesus prioritizes his relationship with God. He prioritizes his relationship with his Father. And that's verses 35 to 39. Now, our culture is a very celebritified, if that's such a word, if I've not just made up a word there, a celebritified culture. We've got all sorts of celebrities and they get their cameras shoved in their faces. They get asked about what they think about all sorts of questions. They get people tracking them on their holiday destinations and taking photos of them and all sorts, Now, I don't know about you, that sounds pretty unappealing in lots of ways, doesn't it? But I suspect there's also a small part of you that would also enjoy the attention, the praise, the people hanging on every word you say, the people saying, oh, isn't she wonderful? Whatever she says, it's just dripping with wisdom and beauty. There's a part of you that would be tempted to play to it, to encourage it, to bask in the glory of having people hang on your every words. Now, Jesus has that sort of opportunity here to enjoy the limelight, the praise, that sharp intake of breath from the crowd every time he heals someone else. He's got that sort of opportunity here. here. This is his first on-the-job sort of test. He's had that testing in the wilderness. But what will he do here where he's tested and he gets the opportunity to pursue fame and fortune and celebrity? And what he does is he discourages it. There's a theme that runs through these verses. You can miss if you don't spot it. Verse 34, what does Jesus do there? The evening's there, the sun's set, Jesus is casting out demons. But notice what he does when he does it. He gives these demons instructions. He says to them, you're not allowed to speak. And what's interesting is it doesn't suggest that it's because they're going to tell fibs about him. It says they're not allowed to speak because they knew him. The demons, when they've spoken earlier, back in verse 24, they say, I know who you are, the Holy One of God. They know who Jesus is. What they may say may be truthful things, but Jesus says, I don't want you to speak. I don't want you to tell anyone about me. Then you carry on into verses 35 and 39, and Jesus ignores the crowds, ignores the expectations of all the disciples, and he goes off somewhere completely alone. And then verses 40 to 45 onwards, after Jesus heals this man with leprosy, what he says in verse 44 is, say nothing to anyone about this. Don't tell anyone. Doesn't this all seem pretty counterintuitive? Isn't the reason he came because he does want people to know who he is? So now he's saying, don't tell anyone. How does that make sense? We're going to come back to that at the end. Hopefully by the end we'll be able to answer that question. But for now, let me just point this out. At every point here in these verses we're reading, Jesus forgoes the acclaim and the popularity and the celebrity status that he could have enjoyed. And in doing so, he gives us an example. Maybe there's no danger of you becoming a celebrity, but you know, there are times when people don't need to know what you did for them, when you don't need to point out the favour that you did, because otherwise they might not notice. Just doing the right thing is enough. It's not about other people noticing. It's not about telling other people what we've done. So what does Jesus do instead? Verse 35, he gets up very early, long before daylight, and he does this having had a very busy, tiring day. You know, they would normally have gone to bed when the sun sets, but he's up into the darkness, healing all these different people. So the next day you'd thought would be a day when, well, doesn't he deserve a lie-in? Surely this is a lazy morning, read the Saturday papers sort of morning, but he gets up early. After a whirlwind of activity, he goes out to a solitary place. Now, when Simon and these other disciples find him and they say, everyone's looking for you, in verse 36, verse 37, what do they want him to do? They want him to come back to Capernaum and carry on healing. That's how they see all this panning out. But actually, Jesus has different plans. Verse 38, he says, I'm going to go to the other towns as well. He says, I'm going to preach there too. He says, that's why I've come. For this purpose I have come forth. So in verse 39, you find him preaching throughout the whole of Galilee, going into lots of different synagogues, casting out demons there. Jesus doesn't want to create a healing centre in Capernaum. Why not? It's because the crowds clamouring for success, for his attention, are not a sign of success. Not for him. They would be by our standards, perhaps. But he doesn't want hysteria and enthusiasm and frenzied excitement just in Capernaum, in one place. He's not about to launch his attack on the Romans and take over the nation. Actually, he's shown Capernaum who he was already. We've got to remember with miracles always have a point. They always have a lesson that Jesus is trying to teach with them. Miracles are called signs, and they're signs of a deeper spiritual truth. Well, he's shown Capernaum those signs. He's taught them the truths. He's shown them he can cast out demons. He's shown them he has power. He's shown them he can heal, not just on the outside, but on the inside. Yeah, he could do it again and again and again, but they've got the signs now, and they've got the opportunity to respond to them. Do you know the sad thing with Capernaum, where all those events in the first part of chapter 1 happened? The sad thing about Capernaum is how they respond. So later on, Jesus will speak. This is Matthew 11, verse 34. And he speaks about Capernaum as a town. He speaks to Capernaum. Matthew 11, verse 34, he says this: "If the mighty works which were done in you had been done in Sodom, it would have remained until this day." He's comparing Capernaum to Sodom. He's saying, if Sodom saw the stuff you got to saw, the amazing miracles I've done here in Capernaum, if they saw what you've seen, they'd have turned. They'd have repented. They would still be around today. But he says this: "I say to you, it shall be more tolerable for the land of Sodom in the day of judgment than for you." He says Capernaum saw mighty works, but they didn't believe. Now they want more and more signs, don't they? They want him to carry on healing and healing day after day in Capernaum. Do you know what Jesus would say? "However many miracles I do, it'll never be enough for some people." Do you know one of the biggest fallacies people will say sometimes is, "If I had enough evidence, I'd believe." I don't think that's the case. Do you know, Richard Dawkins was honest enough to admit this recently. Someone asked Richard Dawkins, "What evidence would persuade you that God is there and that it is real? What would persuade you?" Here's his answer. I'm quoting now. It gives us an insight into his perspective, his mindset. "What would persuade you? Well, I'm starting to think nothing would, which in a way goes against the grain, because I've always paid lip service to the view that a scientist should change his mind when evidence is forthcoming." You see, he sees the inconsistency of what he's saying, but at the same time, he's being honest and saying, "Nothing will persuade me." And he knows that he shouldn't say something like that because he's a scientist, but nevertheless, he's being honest and saying, "Nothing will change my mind. I am fundamentally committed to a position that I will not believe there is a God." Actually, that's what you've got in the crowds in Capernaum too. Jesus says later on, "You had these great mighty works." There is a question we've got to ask ourselves. What am I doing with the evidence God has given me? Do you know, we can always say, "Well, I think God should do that. I think he should do this. Give me that particular piece of evidence." We've been given huge evidence. Tremendous evidence in the Bible, in creation, in our consciences that we know right and wrong. What are we doing with the evidence we've been given? Now, going back to these verses again, Simon in verse 36. What does Simon really want to do? Simon here is trying to set the agenda for Jesus. He thinks there's a certain way the kingdom of God is going to be ushered in, and he thinks Jesus should go back and carry on doing these miracles. But Jesus isn't going to dance to anyone else's tune. Why? Because Jesus's highest priority is his relationship with his Father. He's not just going off into the wilderness to play solitaire or read the paper. He's going somewhere quiet to pray. He goes off somewhere to give that relationship the time it deserves, the time it needs. There's something important here we need to take to heart. Prayer has a higher priority to Jesus than projects, than activity. Prayer has a higher priority than projects. Do you know, every person in the world has an unwritten, unspoken pecking order of priorities in their lives. You do, I do, everyone does. We have priorities. So do you know, imagine you invite someone over for a film, to watch a film with you one evening, and they say to you, "I'm really sorry, I don't have time." Do you know what they actually mean? Or do you know what you mean? Or do you know what I mean when we say, I'm sorry, I don't have time? What we mean is, there's something else that's a higher priority to me. And that may be good and right. I'm not saying that's a wrong thing. I'm saying perhaps there is something much more important. I'm really sorry, I don't have time. I can't because my children are screaming and crying and I need to look after, you know. Sometimes saying I don't have time is good and right. What I mean is there's a priority there. We do have time for things, but just we make choices about what we will give our priorities to. So what's your priority? What comes first when there's a clash? Maybe you've never written them down, but could you list out what are my priorities with the way I use my time and the things I'm going to do? What Jesus is teaching us here is that your first priority as a believer, as a follower of Jesus, is your relationship with your Heavenly Father. And if anything gets in the way of that, our priorities are wrong. They are wrong priorities. So we've got all sorts of pressures in life. I'm aware of that. We have family pressures. We have work pressures where the boss says, I need you to do that today. We have commitments to all sorts of things outside of work. We have books we're reading and TV series that are on cliffhanger. All sorts of things we want to do in life. And we're not talking about good stuff versus bad stuff here. Jesus has a choice here between doing something good, going back to Capernaum and doing more miracles, and doing what is best. We're talking here about good versus best. That's why this applies even towards our Christian service, the work we do serving the Lord. If your Christian life is all about activity and activism, if you're the sort of person who will drop anything to help anyone anytime, if you're the sort of person who's always doing stuff, busy, 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 because the Lord wants us to serve, but time alone with your Father comes right down low, Jesus says, no, no, it's wrong. It might be good, but it's not best. You know, the same can be true in reverse as well. I can think of someone I knew, and lots of people would say about this man, he's a very godly man. And you know what they meant by that, I think, is he spent loads of time reading books at home written by Puritans. And he may well have been a very godly man, but their view of what a godly man was someone who spent loads of time reading books at home. Jesus here perfectly combines busy, active, tiring, sacrificial service, hard work where he gives himself when the sun's set, but he keeps on going late into the night. He combines that with private devotion, time with his Father, worship, worship in private, worshipping together as a church. So the question we've got to ask ourselves is, have I got that balance? Or am I pursuing the one and not the other? Am I giving myself to my Father? Am I spending time with him? And do you know that same principle has to govern our church life as well? A church that prays and never goes, never works, that's not right. Jesus says that's not right. And a church that goes and works and is always busy but doesn't pray, that's not right either. Jesus here, as the perfect Son of God, perfectly does both things. And so must we. So that's Jesus' first priority. He prioritizes his relationship with his Father. Secondly, verses 40 to 45, Jesus prioritizes healing from sin. He prioritizes healing from sin. So we've got this account now of this leper who comes to Jesus, and people with leprosy lived awful lives. Now, we could talk about the disease. It was a hideous disease. You may know some things about the boils, the way that the wounds would erupt and show raw flesh. It was a hideous, smelly disease. But then there was the social daily humiliation. You had to walk along the street shouting, unclean, unclean. You had to tear your clothes. You had to leave your hair unkempt and messy. And you had to do all this to make sure no one came near you. So you were socially isolated. And people talk about the terror of 2 weeks of social isolation because of this virus. Well, okay, this is a life sentence of isolation. A life sentence not just of social living on the fringes of society, but a life sentence of spiritual distance as well. They couldn't go to the temple, they couldn't offer sacrifices. Added to that, that the rabbis of the time had created all sorts of cruel rules. So lepers weren't allowed to enter anyone's house. Here's another one, just to show you how random some of these rules were. If a man with leprosy stood under a tree and somebody else walked by, that clean man would become unclean. He'd become ceremonial unclean. So no standing under trees either if you had leprosy. In all these sorts of scenarios they created. So simply in approaching Jesus, this man is breaking all sorts of social conventions. He's not meant to be doing this. He's meant to be well away from everyone. And notice what he asks for. He doesn't say, please would you heal me? He says, if you're willing, you can make me clean. Now that word clean is a Bible word that has special Bible meanings, if I can put it that way. Cleanness and uncleanness takes you back into the Old Testament. There were lots of things that would make people ceremonially unclean. And it didn't mean you'd sinned. So a woman after childbirth is unclean. She's categorised as unclean. If you touched the carcass of an animal, you'd be unclean for a while. There's nothing wrong with doing it. It just meant you were unclean. And if you had leprosy, you were unclean as well. And God created these categories of clean and unclean to teach Israel so that it was built into the fabric of their lives and their daily, the way they lived every day, to teach them about purity and holiness and the need to separate ourselves from sin. The fact that this is a cursed world. So all those things, the things that made people unclean, were reminders. This is a cursed world. It's why childbirth is painful. It's why animals die and there are such things as carcasses. It's why leprosy as a disease exists. All the things that manifested the effect of the curse of sin were unclean or made you unclean. Jesus wanted people to learn about the fall, about sin. And every day in their lives, this was a part of their thinking they were to have. So what this man is asking for when he says, please make me clean, yeah, it would include healing, but what he wants is to participate in society and in worship. He wants to be able to go to the temple. He wants to be a part of God's people instead of being an outcast. And so Jesus does something so startling, so unexpected. He reaches out and touches him. Now, that's something you would never do. You would never go near a leprosy. You would never touch someone like that. What's amazing here, you think about it, Jesus didn't have to do that, did he? Jesus can heal people when he's not in the same room as them. He can heal people when he's not in the same city. It's not as if he has to touch, because unless he touches, he can't heal. So this is a deliberate touching. He's choosing to do it. He's not doing it as a part of the healing in and of itself. He's touching when there's no actual need to do so. Now it says he's moved with compassion. And he is. There is compassion in what he's doing. But there's also two theological truths that his touch shows us and shows this man. The first one is this. He's showing in his touch that he cannot be infected by sin. He cannot be made unclean. Remember we said with this man with leprosy, he has to stay away from other people because if he touched someone else, if I had leprosy and I went over and I touched Colin, not only am I still unclean, he's unclean as well now. And I could go around and touch all of you and we'd all be unclean. This man was permanently unclean. When Jesus touches him, what happens? The flow is reversed. And this time, instead of both of them ended up unclean, they both end up clean. That would never normally happen. Normally, if you touch someone with leprosy, you become unclean too. Here, Jesus isn't infected. And not only is he not infected, he can reach out and touch the untouchable, someone who no one else would go near. And it's a picture of how we can do that with our sins. How with this man with leprosy, what he's showing is he can reach out and he can deal with sin. In its most hideous, ugly, disgusting forms, he can do that with us. There's no sin too messy. No sin too deeply built within us. So he's showing that he can't be made unclean. He can't be infected. But secondly, Jesus is showing that he can do something the law can't. He's doing something. He can do something that the law can't. Here's a little bit of more theology for you that helps with the Old Testament. What was the purpose of separating out lepers in the Old Testament? Well, it was to maintain the purity of the nation of Israel. Because God set up, in the Old Testament, a series of concentric circles. You know what I mean by concentric circles? A really big circle, then a slightly smaller one inside that, slightly smaller again and again, until you get to a very small little circle right in the middle. Let me explain to you what I mean. Biggest circle, the world. The whole world was unclean and cursed from the fall. Inside of that, God chooses one nation. It's our next circle. One nation of Israel. A nation of his people, a holy nation, set apart for God. Within that nation, there was a city. Jerusalem is our next circle, slightly smaller again. A holy city, a city for God. What do you find inside that temple, that city of Jerusalem? Is the temple. It's our next smaller circle. The temple, God's holy temple. Think about how the temple was built. You've got a series of courts. An outer court, a court where Gentiles can go. And then inside there, you've got more courts, further towards the middle, towards the holiest place of the temple. A court for women, a court for men, and then a court for priests, and then the holy place. And then inside that, the Holy of Holies, getting smaller and smaller. And within that, the Ark of the Covenant, God's dwelling place on earth. I guess it's a bit like if you're trying to get into somewhere with lots of security. You have to go through one set of checks. And then you have to go through another way. You have to empty out your bag and they search through it. And then you go through the next stage and they pat you down. There are loads of barriers separating God's presence with his people in the Ark of the Covenant from the sinful, cursed world. And the purpose of all these barriers is to show just how holy God is, just how separate from sin he is. And the laws in the Old Testament, well, that's how it was possible for God to dwell with his people. But you know, all those laws really did was made it possible to maintain the status quo. Here's what the Old Testament was. Here's what Jesus does that the law can't. All that law could do was maintain God's presence in the Ark of the Covenant, in the temple, layer after layer. Here, the leprosy is gone. All those barriers removed. God directly touches a sinful man. God reaches out. Direct communication. God's presence with a sinner. And he touches him. And there's no barriers anymore. Do you know all the obedience to the laws of God in the world could never have healed this man? This man could have been the most righteous man, obeying all the letter of the law and the Old Testament law. But what he needed, and about what we all need, is the healing touch of God in our lives, to reach out and touch us, for his presence with us. So we can say those same words that man with leprosy said, if you're willing, you can make me clean. Notice after that, Jesus tells the man to go and show himself to the priest and bring, he's to bring an offering. It's what the Old Testament law demanded, that if someone was healed from leprosy, they couldn't just self-declare it. It would be the priest who would act as an independent adjudicator, who'd say, yeah, it's really gone, the leprosy has disappeared. So Jesus wants this man to obey the law. The law will never heal. The law will never bring life. But he still wants his people to obey the law. It still pleases him. Right, as we finish off, let's go back to that theme that we said earlier on, draws all these verses together. Remember we looked at in verse 34 how the demons are told not to speak about Jesus, how he then declines the opportunities for public ministry, more healings in Capernaum, how he then tells the leper in verse 44, don't tell anyone. But then you notice the leper does do it anyway. So in verse 45, Jesus can't even enter the cities anymore. The reason is it's all become so unmanageable, so busy, so chaotic in the cities. So you go into chapter 2 and you find there that when he does go back into Capernaum some days later and he goes to a house and the word gets around, so many people gather that people are lowering, making holes in the roof and lowering them through them. It is chaotic. He's staying away for that reason. It's just so unmanageable with the crowds in the cities. Why does Jesus want to keep things under wraps here? It's because people are always going to misunderstand him until the cross. You ever played a game, you know, when someone says, let's play a card game, and then they say to you, I'm not going to explain the rules now. Easiest thing to do is just to play the game, and if we just do a round, you'll get it. But if I start explaining the rules, it's way too complicated for you. Jesus' life at this point is like that. He can explain who he is and why he's come, but people aren't going to understand until the cross. They're always going to have, and you see this with the disciples, they will keep on misunderstanding him, keep on seeing him as the sort of Messiah they want to have. Someone who's going to overthrow the Romans, someone who's going to build a physical kingdom. Going to keep on misunderstanding him. And here's the key point. If Jesus lets himself get swept along with the excitement of it all, the celebrity status, the miracle healer in Capernaum, everyone can come. If Jesus gets swept along with that and stays being Mr. Popular the whole of his life, he won't fulfill the mission he came to carry out. Jesus knows his mission is not to become more and more popular. His plan is very different. He knows his destiny is to be despised, rejected, crucified, and that's going to happen outside a city, rejected by his own people. Jesus has to reach the point where his own people see him as a leper, where he becomes unclean, cursed, hanging on a tree. So the picture we're presented in these verses is a saviour where the door is wide open for fame, popularity, success, and at every moment he is determined to eschew it, to decline it, to turn away from opportunities for self-promotion and glory. He says, don't tell anyone. He doesn't want that sort of fame. And instead he chooses the path that will lead to death on a Roman cross outside the city for unclean, sinful people. It was so unexpected. No one there could see it. They didn't know what was going on. But Jesus sees his mission, even at this point, so clearly. See what I mean when I say Jesus is so unexpected and yet so glorious. So glorious in what he comes to do for us.